From the Sky News Centre, police say there must be other victims of a man who's been ordered to spend the rest of his life in jail for murdering a woman in Swindon 13 years ago. Christopher Halliwell, who was already in prison for killing Sian O'Callaghan, gave no reaction as he was sentenced for Becky Godden's murder. Becky's dad, John, says she was an amazing daughter.
Wonderful, absolutely brilliant, wicked, absolutely beautiful person. It's going to take a long time for me to sink in. I mean, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. It has mentally scarred me, you know, as a person and that.
Defence Secretary Michael Fallon has called for Russian commanders to be put in the dock for an attack on a UN aid convoy in Syria. 20 people died in Monday's bombing. The mother of a schoolgirl says she'll continue to fight for justice after two men were cleared of raping and killing her daughter. Samson D'Souza and Placido Carvalho had been accused of drugging 15-year-old Scarlett Keeling and leaving her unconscious on a beach in Goa. New proposals on tackling fatigue are being considered by EasyJet pilots who were planning to strike. Members of the British Airline Pilots Association had voted in favour of industrial action, but talks have been held to try to resolve the row. The airline hopes agreement can be reached to avert major disruption during October half-term. And it's been revealed Monty Python star Terry Jones has been diagnosed with dementia. The 74-year-old comedian is suffering from primary progressive aphasia, which affects his ability to speak. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Gray.
BCFM 93.2. Local music, local news, the hits you love, and the information you need. Why go anywhere else than Bristol's fastest growing radio station? The award-winning BCFM 93.2. We love this city.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news 100 years ago this week, the Battle of the Somme was raging. Contrary to what Michael Gove called a just war, one of the most pointless mass human sacrifices in history, the Somme saw the first ever use of tanks by the British Army, and there were over a million British, German and French casualties. Germany sued for peace in October 1916, and the Battle of the Somme ended inconclusively in November the same year. 100 years ago. Tonight, we look back at that peace effort and ask why military commander Lord Haig at the British government of the day said no to peace and carried on with another 2 years of slaughter. Also, Israeli Independence Day really divides Jews. Some think it's a celebration, but for others, it's Napka Day, a day of mourning. We hear from the London Orthodox Jews who believe the Israeli state isn't Jewish at all. And have Egyptian state media been listening to this show? They say 9/11 was made up to justify the war on terror, and we say they're right. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 21 Celsius, still fairly warm. Mainly cloudy on Saturday, sunshine and showers, though, on Sunday. Windy, though, throughout the weekend. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius, wet and windy at the beginning of the week, sunnier though towards the end. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of October, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. Hi Martin, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks very much.
First of all, Martin, what's happening at the City Council? Is anything you'd like to flag up for us? Because we've seen a few months now, 6 months or so, of a new Labour administration and the Green Party flagging. I mean, for years, the Green Party was adding councillors. Now you've lost a few, haven't you?
Well, our numbers are at 11 now. We're still the third largest group on the council. We did lose some seats. We also gained some. There was overall across the whole city certainly a swing towards Labour. We call it the Corbyn effect. But one or two of our seats were lost by a tiny handful of votes. And I think some people might be regretting how they voted now that they've put in another cuts administration.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Labour is going down and down in the polls. If there was to be a local election here in the city, let alone a general election, Labour would probably come out really badly right now compared to back in May.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, if we had an election, we'd know.
No, it's the polls. Look at the polls. Come on, you're in denial.
I think, obviously, the struggles at national level in the Labour Party are having some effect, but I think there was a fairly strong...
They're having an enormous effect. They are. They're going... I mean, you're basically below the Conservatives in the polls now, whereas before all this bun fight began with Owen Smith and Jeremy Corbyn in this leadership contest, Labour was actually riding high, and actually it was just after the local elections where they did extremely well, really. I mean, gaining the Mayor of Bristol here and the Mayor of London. Now things are looking really rotten for Labour.
Right, well, I mean, what are we talking about national polls? Are we talking about in Bristol? In Bristol, we've got 4 years of Labour administration. That's it. It's as simple as that. And it's not just the Labour administration. The Greens are in the administration. The Lib Dems are in the administration. The Tories are in the administration. So we've got an all-party administration in Bristol with a Labour majority, which is going to be in power for the next 4 years. That's absolutely clear.
Currently, I think there isn't a Labour majority, is there, of course?
Ah, because of some suspensions from the party.
Interesting.
Martin, yes, tell us about that, Martin.
Well, I really largely know just what I've read, which is three of the members of what was the majority, 37 out of 70 seats across the city, are currently suspended Labour members. So that may well be redressed. We might find out this coming weekend, or it may take some time. But what it does mean, there are only 34 in the ruling, the majority.
Yeah, so they only now have a majority of one.
To be honest, though, that's just symptomatic of the general mess that Labour's in, which is frankly disappointing. Nationally, if you want an effective opposition, you don't have a party that's sort of ripping itself apart, really.
Well, I mean, I'm obviously a Corbynista, as many would be aware, and I think that the Labour MPs who've stabbed Corbyn in the back are going to get their answer tomorrow when he's re-elected with a thumping majority, and they should never have done what they've done, but they have, and that we are where we are. Well, we need to change the electoral system.
Since it's been so...
That's got to happen.
Since it's been so damaging for the Labour Party, why have they done it? And assuming that the polls are right,
well,
and Jeremy Corbyn does
look,
win.
The problem is the electoral system. We're forced into, you have to do all this infighting before you get to your first past the post poll, and that's and you've basically got two parties fighting to stay in one team. And if there was PR, as there is in Northern Ireland or Denmark or Scotland, then what would happen is people could vote what they really wanted, say Green or Corbyn, and then they could transfer their votes further into the centre.
Yeah.
Straightforwardly.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Now, so it's Hibak Jama and Mike Langley who've been this week banned from casting their vote and suspended from the Labour Party. Also, campaign officer for Bristol West, Andy Burkitt. Now, Martin, I imagine you know Andy.
I do, yeah.
What's his role in the party? He's obviously not a councillor,
well,
is he?
No, he's just a very, very active member. I mean, he's getting on now. I mean, he's 70-something, but he did a massive amount of work for us. He's a real hard worker. He does all the work. I'm astonished that he's been suspended, and I can't imagine what it is. I mean, Thangam Debonair has said, who's the MP, has said, well, she thinks it's silly that he's been suspended. I don't know what it's about. I mean, I've only found out this evening when I came in that this is what was going on.
It does seem as if it may be a way of stopping a proper democratic election within the Labour Party to be suspending lots of the members. What do you think about both of you about that? Maybe you first, Martin. If you could, I mean, I know you're looking at this from the outside,
yeah.
but what do you make of it? It doesn't seem very democratic to be suspended. suspending so many members of the party?
It is, frankly, a bit of a mess, and saying you can't vote for the first 6 months or whatever of your membership, or that you can be a supporter but you can't really unless you pay extra to be a more expensive supporter, that does seem a bit of a mess. And we've just had a long-planned national leadership election. Everyone got involved. No one's ripped the party apart. We're all content with the result because it's the outcome of our democratic process, and we're carrying on as a coherent United Green Party. And unfortunately, Labour doesn't seem to be able to achieve that.
Not everyone in the Green Party agrees, though, do they? I mean, how do you cope when you've got something like, I mean, for example, Caroline Lucas last night on BBC Question Time saying that there needs to be a second referendum. I mean, do you agree with that? Because there's a lot of people in the Green Party that wouldn't.
Well, people have different points of view within the Green Party, and that's celebrated. We debate our positions, we work together, we talk, we don't kind of rip each other apart. And I think the point about the, well, we're probably not going to spend the next hour talking about Brexit, but there are constitutional issues, there are issues around the supremacy of Parliament, issues around what people thought they were voting for. So I'm as aghast as everyone else, a lot of people in Bristol certainly are, about the sort of mess we're in, this sort of limbo period. Brexit means Brexit, but we don't know what that means.
Yeah, this is Brexit means Brexit, but what does Brexit mean? Indeed. Does Brexit mean? No one really understands that. But, I mean, to be fair, Martin, we always knew this was going to happen. It's a 2-year negotiation period. We're now in the middle of that. The negotiations are going on. We know pretty much for certain that if we want to stay in the single market, we won't be able to control our borders and migration across our borders. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that, and Theresa May has said very clearly that we are therefore going to be outside the single market because we do want to control our borders. So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of negotiations to do outside that, really.
Well, I don't know. I just know that my colleagues across Europe are kind of laughing at Britain to some extent and sort of weeping at the sort of mess we got ourselves into, all because of some Conservative UKIP infighting, really, which is what I think is behind it all.
Well, but it was a national referendum, wasn't it?
It was.
That's not just, I mean, there was a lot of infighting involved in the beginning of it, but it was a test of public opinion, and it really, I think, caught a lot of people involved in politics. Well, actually, our finger was not on the pulse on this issue of whether the British people want to be part of the EU or not.
I think the whole debate was a bit of a mess, frankly. I mean, an awful lot of issues are coming out now that were never debated.
So you question the whole vote?
The quality of the process.
Do you actually question the vote itself? You think people didn't have the right information to make the decision?
I know what the results of the crosses on the bits of paper were, but that doesn't mean I think people were clear what their cross meant or why they were doing it.
Martin?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that George Osborne was in Chicago yesterday and he said that Britain did not vote for a hard Brexit. And if you think about it, we've got 52% voting yes, 48% voting no to the proposition that we're going to leave. But of the 52%, maybe 5% voted for a soft Brexit. They want to leave the European Union, but they don't want to leave the single market. And in actual fact, of course, the majority of Conservative MPs, Liberal MPs and Labour MPs do not want to leave the single market. And as the Japanese pointed out when Theresa May went to China, if you leave the single market, we're taking our money and we're going off to Poland. And most people haven't been, and we'll have to have some debate about this. If we're going to go for hard Brexit, then we're going to go for hard Brexit, and that means we're going to have tariffs on our exports. We'll have to use WTO rules to deal with everybody, and that means that a lot of businesses in Britain are going to close, especially multinational companies. They're just going to go off somewhere.
Martin?
Yes,
Martin.
Yeah, there are severe sort of likely economic impacts, some of which have already been felt. Investments being postponed or cancelled. We've got a bunch of regulators from the Environment Agency head office in Bristol, the largest environmental regulation body in Europe, probably, and it was stripped of a load of staff under the austerity cuts, and now a load have been seconded to sort of find out what regulations exist that we might now have to replace, abandon, change or whatever. So they're not even doing the job of protecting our health and our environment right now because of the muddle we're in for the next few years.
Back to the story we started with, though. These two Labour Bristol City Councils are suspended, leaving the Labour group on the City Council with only a majority of one now.
One below half the votes. There are 34 after three have been suspended. They had 37 out of 70.
Oh, okay.
And they're now 34 not suspended.
So the Labour Party aren't in any more the ruling administration?
Well, the mayor is a Labour politician.
But the Labour group, for example, the Labour group leader and the Labour group is not...
I don't know what it means for the place on committees, because committees were all adjusted to allow a majority of the ruling group on the committee.
It's been, I mean, it's difficult to fathom. I mean, I've had a go at it, but difficult to fathom exactly what these people are supposed to have said or done in order to warrant suspension. And quite clearly, when they are suspended, what happens is they get sent a nice little note saying that make sure you don't tell anyone why you were suspended, because that may prejudice the hearing we're going to have to decide whether or not you should stay on as a member.
I'm sure they'll all appeal and they'll all kind of go through some sort of process, but yeah, I have to say I don't really know what it'll be.
The most important thing, Martin, though, is that they've lost their vote.
Well, as I say, I only found out about this...
Sorry, in the Labour election, which is happening tomorrow,
I mean, the fact is they remain councillors, even if they're suspended from the Labour Party.
Yeah, indeed.
So they'll still, you know, they've still got all the legal powers that councillors have, and no doubt they'll carry on voting in the way that they would always have voted. It's really an internal Labour Party matter.
OK, one of the most interesting things on this, though, and enlightening, is a couple of comments that were made on the Bristol Post version of this story. Come on, BBC, open up your stories to comments, and we can get some interesting info too. Of course, you can't verify this, but we've got someone called Rob Wilkinson commenting on there. Says it seems if you don't agree with the Parliamentary Labour Party and say anything against them, you get suspended. He says, very democratic, not. And also, someone calling themselves Just Can, also on Monday this week, says the Labour National Executive has suspended over 3,000 Labour Party members and supporters for allegedly making remarks that are against Labour Party rules. After the leadership election, suspended and expelled members are going to be helped by thousands of other fair-minded Labour Party members to compare all the remarks made by some Labour MPs, and then members will demand the MPs are treated like for like in the same manner as the suspended and expelled members. Now, Martin, what you're saying there, I'd be interested to get your comments on this, is, hang on a minute, we're going to hold, after the Labour Party conference and after this leadership election is over, we're going to hold the Labour MPs to the same standards as the National Executive has been holding the members.
Well, this is all a bit mysterious to me, because the National Executive elections in the summer, the Corbyn slate won overwhelmingly. 3,000 plus people have not been allowed to vote in the leadership election out of 600,000 votes. And some people have been, most of the people suspended seem to be left wingers, although some right wingers have also been suspended, like the chap who was accusing the Corbynistas of being Sturmabteilung, stormtroopers. He's been suspended. And I think if people are going to be suspended for saying what they think, then obviously that's going to cut both ways. It's going to cut both ways. The left are going to say, if you're going to suspend people, then we're going to suspend people too.
Labour Party is beginning to sound a bit authoritarian.
Well, what do you mean, a bit authoritarian? It's always been authoritarian. This is the way politics is done. If we were a smaller party and we had proportional representation, we might even have two parties, it would all be different. But because it's a big party and a potential party of government, you've got all these people struggling to get hold of the steering wheel.
So I'm taking it both of you think that Jeremy Corbyn will be elected tomorrow again as Labour leader. Martin Fodor, what do you mean?
I think it looks quite likely.
I think so. I mean, what I'm looking for, I mean, I know what the Smith camp are looking for, because this time last year, Jeremy Corbyn got about 60% of the vote, and they had several other candidates against him, and he got more than 50%, so there was never a runoff. They are hoping that they can do better than that, and that Smith will get over 40% of the vote, so they can say that at least they've got, you know, that Corbyn's mandate has been damaged, because there's a lot more people voting this time. And I hope that in actual fact they're going to be humiliated. It may be, that's what I'm hoping, is that the right wing of the party are going to give a very severe...
So you'll be cheering if Owen Smith is humiliated, will you, one of your fellow party
members? No, listen, the right wing of the party chose to have this contest. Kerry McCarthy, who's our local MP, said we don't even need to have an election, but Corbyn's just got to stand down.
She also spoke about Jeremy Corbyn as a cult-like figure, didn't she?
Well, she can say what she likes, and I'll say what I like, and the fact is, when the votes are counted tomorrow, we'll see which, when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller.
Okay, back to the real world then, folks. And out there on the roads, the M32, major disruption as 7 months of M32 Metro bus works is set to start in Bristol city centre. Commuters can expect further traffic misery. Metro bus works for 7 months as the West of England Partnership, with the body taking control of the controversial bus project, says major works to extend the M32 southbound bus lane will start before the end of this month. Now, couple of things here. This West of England Partnership, I mean, you have a look at them, and their meetings are actually open to the public, and yet they're deciding lots of things to do with the vast amounts of public money that they're now allocating. What do you make of these? I mean, before we talk about these roadworks, because there's a whole story in itself that there may, at the end of the day, not be an operator for this Metro bus after people have had to put up with this nonsense for the last 18 months, 2 years of roadworks. So who are these West of England Partnership who are in charge of this fiasco?
Well, the West of England Partnership, of course, was put in place because the government wanted business local government partnerships, well, and it includes other members from the university and so on.
I think they've got a few MPs, city councillors, South Gloucestershire, Baines councillors, yeah, scattering of them on there.
It covers the four unitary authorities, the old Cuba county that used to be Avon, and We've raised a lot of questions about effective scrutiny of what it does, and the budget's put in the hands of bodies like the West of England Partnership and the Local Enterprise Partnership, because they have funds now that used to be in public sector.
And the fact of the matter is that the public aren't allowed into these. I think they've got to you've got to give notification beforehand, and they've got to accept and give you permission to come along to one of their so-called public meetings, in which case, actually, it's only a small part of the meeting anyway, which is open to the public.
Well, indeed. And even the members of it from our own party and others, their ability to question what's going on and to challenge and scrutinise, is seriously limited.
Does it sound like a kind of executive coup where you've got the full-time people at the West of England Partnership who are actually just saying, well, we're going to do it like this, and we'll have a few councillors strung along just for a bit of PR and a show to put on?
Well, a bit like that. I mean, it's certainly not an effective, a publicly elected body with the transparency we expect of public
So if
bodies.
Over the next year you find yourself in a jam, either in Bristol city centre or up the M32, then you've got this kind of quango to blame, which is supposed to be doing better than the city councillors used to do, Martin, the West of England Partnership.
Well, I mean, are we going to get a metro mayor as well? Is another issue, which is another fox to chase. I mean, the fact is that Britain is not run by on a democratic basis. The local councils have very little power. We've had a big fuss about electing a mayor, whether we were going to have one, who it was going to be, and it doesn't matter who it is. We've still got to carry out millions of pounds worth of cuts. It doesn't matter who is running it. Mickey Mouse.
And the mystery. Anyone wondering why the speed limits on the M32, rather than a normal motorway, have come down to 40 miles an hour? Well, they've explained it in this article in a kind of oblique way, and that is because they're getting rid of the central reservation. Hey, that's a motorway with no central reservation. It's not a motorway, folks. And that is also, they're also doing something which has proved a bit of a bonus up on the M4, just north of Bristol, in between the M32 and the Almondsbury interchange with the M5, is they're making a fortune there out of speed cameras. So guess what? We're getting speed cameras too on the M32, so they can make a fortune out of those as well. I mean, this is good, of course, for road safety, but certainly if you're effectively on a motorway in the middle of the night with nobody else around, it seems a bit silly to limit people to 30 miles an hour, and if they go over that, then they get a hefty fine and somebody somewhere makes a lot of money. So the speed cameras coming in on the M32. It does seem as if one of the headlines is saying that the M32 is going to be the slowest motorway in the country, Martin.
I don't know if it's slower than the M25, which usually has to sort of park cars on it, obviously, because they expanded that to.
But even at night time, I mean, you can do 70 on the M25 and no one's going to bat an eyelid. It seems that we've got a 30 mile an hour motorway here.
Bristol's route into the national motorway network was built by the city and is, you know, has been debated quite a bit over the years, because what it does is it channels very fast polluting traffic straight into the centre of the city. But people travelling at the average speed, when it is jammed, should have a steadier, more efficient kind of relatively straightforward journey if they can avoid accelerating and braking all the time. It's as you say, at night time it might seem a bit silly.
Well, yes, it's silly for you folks if you're driving, but it's not silly for those who are making the money. I wonder if it's anything to do with this West of England partnership bunch. I wonder. Martin Fodor, what about the Metro bus? Because there's so many, I mean, everyone's having to put up with all this nightmare nonsense in the city centre, lanes coned off where there's nothing actually happening in the lane at all. And obviously the M32, pretty much 2 years of jams there of one sort or another.
Sure.
And yet we're being told that actually maybe there won't be anyone wanting to operate this thing.
Well, there do seem to be some question. I mean, this is a very expensive infrastructure project. It's quite ambitious.
£200 million.
To start with, yeah. And, I mean, my take on it is sort of slightly mixed, because we want major infrastructure projects that do improve public transport. There's no question about that. And to put that sort of thing in place does cause some disruption. You can't quibble about a certain amount of relatively short-term disruption. However, the project itself is such a bodge to try and meet the funding rules. We got, you know, a tram system on one route turned into a guided bus on a different route, turned into a metro bus on yet another route, all designed to meet certain calculations that proved it was viable by saving important people a bit of time and gaining passengers possibly from other bus routes to keep it busy and supposedly viable. And we're picking up all the cost overruns as well, which to me is one of the major issues. It's stripping funds out of a whole series of more sustainable transport projects across Bristol and beyond to actually deal with all the shortcomings in its initial budget.
Meanwhile, the oil companies are laughing because you're sitting there in a traffic jam, chugging out loads of fumes and paying extra, using extra oil.
Well, there's certainly, and that's very unfortunate. But in the longer term, you know, we could say let's hope it works really well and everyone travels on it and it gets them around very quickly and effectively.
Do you think it will?
I have some doubts because the route it's taking, it may do damage to other existing currently viable bus routes, commercial routes that might become non-commercial in future, including through my own ward, and the Gloucester Road A38.
I think one of the most horrendous parts of this cockeyed project is the fact that they're now only talking about having three an hour. Even if they can find someone to operate it.
Really undermines an effective public transport system.
Yeah, it's
if you
about,
can't just turn up and get on.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. If it's going to work, they've got to be reasonably frequent. And every 20 minutes, well, people think, oh, never mind, forget it, I'll hop in the car or go on the bike even. Actually, that's probably a good thing, Martin.
Well, cycling is quickest for a lot of journeys in Bristol. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we basically bodge our way along, don't we? We just bodge, and we've got, this is another bodge. I mean, in Seattle, in the United States, as I've said before on the show, you've got free buses, just free. Everybody just gets on the bus and goes where they want to go. Hop on, hop off. You can do that, but we can't do it here, because it's absolutely outside of the sensible conversation that we're supposed to be having.
Where there's a passenger transport authority, we probably could have that. I mean, in Manchester, you get off the train. Certainly last time I'd prepaid a bus ticket to get me to where I was going. But I found the free bus outside the station that would take me around the centre. And, you know, we can run that if we have properly funded, properly managed passenger transport authority.
Where we want. It's called the Transport Group of the West of England Partnership. Oh, yeah, although the public... aren't allowed to go along to these things, and there's no proper scrutiny, you know, absolutely unbelievable.
And part of the price of a Metro Mayor, the prize for a Metro Mayor, the reward for saying yes, let's have one, is maybe we'll get something nearer a proper transport authority. But we'll wait and see.
Two Bristol Academy schools are at risk of closure after a potential £1 million shortfall is revealed. The Federation is running Winterbourne International Academy and Sixth Form Centre and Yate International Academy, both in South Gloucestershire. Unions fear there's a risk of closure at schools run by the Riding's Federation of Academies. It faces a potential £1 million shortfall. Concerned staff numbers could be slashed, class sizes increasing, and the curriculum could be cut to deal with the deficit. Martin Summers, I know you work in education. This is, it almost seems to me a little bit like some of the problems that there've been with the privatisation of the health service, where you privatise something and then the body, the business that's then running it, just goes broke.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the bad old days, you see things like schools and hospitals and so on didn't have, they weren't run like businesses and they couldn't go broke. But once you've created a decentralised system and, let a thousand flowers bloom, let's let anybody run an academy, and then if they mess up, they mess up. Like, you see what happened to Southern Cross old people's homes? They went bankrupt and then the government has to step in and bail them out. It's a bit like the banking system, isn't it? That goes bankrupt. And the government's got to step in and bail it out. And if the government's got to step in and bail it out, well, why ain't the government running it in the first place? I mean, we were just talking about transport a minute ago, but I mean, really, we shouldn't have academy schools at all. I mean, we're so used to it now.
You're sitting in one.
Well, I know, but I mean, in actual fact, it's a nonsense, because all the money actually spent is actually government money, but it's been subcontracted to a load of chiselers. It's ridiculous, really. I mean, I know I'm whistling for the wind, saying, why can't we go back to how schools used to be, run by local authorities.
The cane in Victoria?
I just mean understanding, the way the public sector is supposed to operate. It isn't the private sector, although, they're trying to make an awful lot of effort to confuse us that they are similar to the private sector. I mean, at the end of the day, it's government money, therefore it should be accountably spent by the government, not by intermediary bodies that have got no real mandate.
Martin Foda, Green Party councillor, it's the Ridings Federation, Winterbourne International Academy and Sixth Form Centre Yate International Academy. Looks like they may be going bust.
Yeah, well, which is tragic, really. You sort of bribe organisations to set up academies with public money, then they make a mess of it. We have this sort of patchwork, if that's the polite way to put it, of free schools, academies, chains of academies, independent schools, all of this sort of muddle. The local authority actually has a responsibility to find places for everyone who wants to go to school, but has next to no control over anything that's actually going on, certainly in the senior schools. And yes, it seems to be unravelling before our eyes. So it is quite disturbing, because these people's education, as the other Martin said, is publicly funded education kind of falling to pieces.
Does the Green Party have any sort of proper solutions to this?
I mean, we think here in Bristol, authorities should there should be an excellent school for everyone near where they are, so that they don't have to crisscross the city and travel all miles to get anywhere.
The thing is, people don't always travel. The kids don't always travel. Sometimes the parents will just move house to make sure they're nearer.
Which means it depends on your finances.
Yeah.
And it affects housing and house prices and so on. But it creates, housing chaos, travel chaos, and now educational chaos too. It is a bit of a mess, and certainly we wouldn't run it this way if we had any say.
Going back briefly to the story we started with, I really should have played this clip, because I've been meaning to play it for a few weeks now. Her name is Cheryl Atkinson. She used to work for CBS, that's the TV and radio news network, Columbia Broadcasting System, I think it's called, in the United States. And since she left there, she has been going around doing public talks about what she's learnt about various things to do with her industry. She's very critical of the US mainstream media. And the reason I'm bringing this up, Martin, is because we've had a lot of criticism within the Labour Party and in the national media about online bullying and online harassment. And yet there is this other side of this, which is what they call astroturfing, which is where people will come up with a kind of false persona online and almost pretend to be part of, say, for example, a Labour Party member, and from one pack or the other start attacking the other side.
Well, I mean, as we know, online debate, especially anonymous online debate, is often conducted let's put it this way, not as politely as we discuss things in the studio. It's a huge problem, but I think we're going to have to get a clear idea. Either people are allowed to say whatever they like, in which case it's put up or shut up, and no crying for mummies. Or certain things are not going to be said, and if you can't say certain things, then that's got to cut both ways. So if the right wing of the Labour Party can accuse me of being a Nazi stormtrooper, I can take that, and I'll accuse them of being, pro-Nazis themselves. I mean, everybody just say what they think.
And then no one will ever vote Labour again.
Well, that's not the
only issue. If you're having a bun fight like that.
That's not the only issue. We're talking about whether people can say what they think or not. I'm generally in favour of freedom of speech. People say whatever they like, but no crime for mummies.
There is one thing I'd say is anything that's incitement to crime is not freedom of speech. Anyway, Martin Fodor, what do you make of this kind of astroturfing, it's called, where you can kind of come online and almost be a whole group of people who are pretending to be from one faction? It might even be that you've got both factions who are people pretending to be from that faction fighting each other,
A thing. That's right. It's good money if you're in that, you know, if you're delivering the service for them. But not very good if you're a member of the public actually wanting genuine, sort of authentic debate. I mean, astroturfing's kind of long been a phenomenon of pseudo-realistic bodies set up by, you know, vested interests and industry. I didn't think it was so much political parties, but, you know...
Well, it might be the Green Party, mightn't it? Especially since it's supposed to be...
I don't think we've got any money for any fake accounts.
Well, it might be people trying to create division in the Green Party. I mean, we had a discussion on here years ago, Martin, with a guy called Sven, who's a former psychological warfare officer, saying how much they love to... People, big corporations will spend money to fracture groups. Money, but...
We know those with money can do that, yeah. And like I say, astroturfing, it's gone on for a long time with these sort of fake sort of pseudo campaigns or pseudo citizens campaigns that are really industry campaigns and so on.
Well, if anyone out there is a football fan wondering where this term astroturfing comes from, it's
fake
grassroots group of some sort. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Cheryl Atkinson, from former CBS reporter, talking about it.
Astroturfers seek to controversialize those who disagree with them. They attack news organizations that publish stories they don't like, whistleblowers who tell the truth, politicians who dare to ask the tough questions, and journalists who have the audacity to report on all of it. Sometimes astroturfers simply shove intentionally so much confusing and conflicting information into the mix that you're left to throw up your hands and disregard all of it, including the truth. Drown out a link between a medicine and a harmful side effect, say vaccines and autism, by throwing a bunch of conflicting paid-for studies, surveys, and experts into the mix, confusing the truth beyond recognition. And then there's Wikipedia. AstroTurf's dream come true. Billed as the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, the reality can't be more different. Anonymous Wikipedia editors control and co-opt pages on behalf of special interests. They forbid and reverse edits that go against their agenda. They skew and delete information in blatant violation of Wikipedia's own established policies with impunity, always superior to the poor schlubs who actually believe anyone can edit Wikipedia, only to discover they're barred from correcting even the simplest factual inaccuracies. Try adding a footnoted fact or correcting a fact error on one of these monitored Wikipedia pages and poof, sometimes within a matter of seconds you'll find your edit is reversed. In 2012, famed author Philip Roth tried to correct a major fact error about the inspiration behind one of his book characters cited on a Wikipedia page. But no matter how hard he tried, Wikipedia's editors wouldn't allow it. They kept reverting the edits back to the false information. When Roth finally reached a person at Wikipedia, which was no easy task, and tried to find out what was going wrong, they told him he simply was not considered a credible source on himself. A few weeks later, there was a huge scandal when Wikipedia officials got caught offering a PR service that skewed and edited information on behalf of paid, publicity-seeking clients in utter opposition to Wikipedia's supposed policies. All of this may be why, when a medical study looked at medical conditions described on Wikipedia pages and compared it to actual peer-reviewed published research, Wikipedia contradicted medical research 90% of the time. You may never trust what you read on Wikipedia again, nor should you.
Well, that's a staggering figure, Martin Summers, isn't it? 90% of the time, if you go onto Wikipedia to find out about a medical condition, actually, Big Pharma has got there first.
Well, yeah, I mean, and don't forget that, the Pentagon, for example, will have literally thousands of employees sitting online every day engaged in what they term psychological warfare operations.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't say they're the Pentagon. They just go online and try and steer the debate in the directions they want it to go.
I'll just give one. I mean, that was focusing quite a lot on Wikipedia there. I'll give you one example. I mean, one of the things I remember reading years ago and talking to former Freemasons about was the Freemason symbol. symbol where you've got the, I think it's what they call the square and the compasses, which the Masons have on top of their meeting halls and this kind of thing in their literature. And he said, oh, yes, well, this is actually really the ruler and divider, or the square and compasses. But he said, well, actually, it's the ruler and the dividers, because that's what we do. We divide and rule. And I thought, well, that's quite a good little thing, using an illustration to put up on to the Freemason page on Wikipedia. Well, within about 20 seconds, it had been removed. And I went back and appealed it and that sort of thing. And, of course, there's no way to actually put this basic bit of information told to me by a former Mason on a Wikipedia page about Freemasonry. But actually, Martin, what we're really talking about here is some of the conflict that's been going on in the Labour Party, and which will be decided, hopefully, once and for all, or at least for another year, tomorrow. What role do you think this kind of online bullying has played in this?
Well, it's hard to say, because obviously, you know, if we knew exactly what was going on, we'd know what was going on. But, I mean, the Len McCluskey, the head of Unite, said, well, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if MI5 were out there, you know, trolling away, astroturfing away. And, of course, he was then obviously, oh, he's crazy, he's paranoid. He said, no, I know for a fact that people who used to run my union were working for MI5. And, of course, that's a reality. That is a reality.
But I suppose a more serious side of this, the Labour Party aside, Martin Fodor, is when it comes down to things like, you know, making a decision as to whether to vaccinate your child with MMR and whether what the risks are that they might get autism as a result, when you find that the drug companies are actually spending millions of dollars, and probably pounds as well, trying to influence your decision.
Well, yeah, that vaccine is quite an interesting example, because there was a lot of fuss about the supposed side effects that were then discredited by medical evidence. So that's maybe not the best example to use about the influence of the drug companies.
Yeah, but the question is, were they? You know, because
they may have. And the rich and powerful can control media. We had that already before there were kind of fake online personas and, you know, so on.
Well, also, statins is another medical subject where there's a lot of controversy. It does seem to me that whenever you get a report showing that statins actually can be bad for you, then there's almost within a week another big report saying the opposite. So this doesn't seem to me as if we've got good enough journalistic rigour for a lot of this stuff.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of journalism, you know, churning out press releases and then republishing
cutting
them.
Cutting and pasting stuff, basically.
I think if I could get back to, I mean, because you started this off as talking about, you know, the leader of the Labour Party. Yeah. I mean, what this sideshow, if it is a sideshow, this sort of coup, it's been called a coup, and the novel, A Very, Very British Coup, has had a little bit of a revival recently.
Good, yeah.
The film and the book about the establishment kind of putting paid to radical politics. And I think what actually matters is months have now been spent not providing effective, coherent, determined opposition to a government that has kind of very questionable mandate, small enough vote that put their MPs in, you know, compared to other votes in the first place. And we don't have that effective opposition and challenge and scrutiny. And that's actually what we need for good decision-making and good politics.
And in the meantime, we have a bit of a breakdown in the justice system. There's a very good programme. In fact, it was an article, I think, in the Daily Mail, which sparked it, this is one of the things where you throw your hands up with the BBC and you think, why does it have to wait until we have an article in the Daily Mail before the BBC pick up the ball and do an interesting programme on it? And this is Money Box. We're going to hear a little clip from now about a certain place in Northampton, which is sort of posing as a county court, where which are doing mass processing of county court judgments by big corporations. I mean, I picked up on this because I personally was taken to Northampton County Court by Bristol Water with a debt, and I sent in a little form basically saying, no, this is completely not on them asking for this money from me, which was a defence form, only to find out about a month later that they'd somehow Bristol Water had wangled it for them to completely ignore my defence form, have no defence, and just to pass judgment on me without considering my defence. But anyway, this isn't just me. There are thousands and thousands of people across the country that this is being done. It's effectively a kind of fraudulent use of the county court process, particularly through this place in Northampton. So let's have a little listen now to a clip from the latest Radio 4 Money Box programme, which looked in a little bit more depth at this after the Daily Mail had flanked it up for us.
Michael Green runs an online checking service where, for a fee, you can carry out a deep search to check if there's a CCJ against your own name. Since this issue hit the newspapers earlier in the week, Michael's company has been deluged with people trying to find out if they've been the subject of a CCJ.
We had 2,000 applications from people, and what was so startling about it is about 17% of those results that came back had CCJs registered against an address, which is huge. That's much higher than what I would have thought. I was guessing like 0.1%.
He reckons 500,000 people could be in this position, although there's no way of knowing for sure.
At the very least, companies should be obliged to do a check to make sure the address they have is the most accurate one. Second, I think the rules should be changed such that first-class post does not suffice. The current system has leaned way too far in favour of companies that want to process hundreds of thousands of claims speculatively per year, and this results in huge human damage.
Michael Green ending Ed Davis' report.
So that's a little clip from Moneybox there, but they're estimating about 500,000 people, Martin Fodor, may have been victims of this. It's effectively a kind of scam where rather than take you to the county court in the normal way, they're going through this kind of mass data processing centre where, certainly my experience was, they don't listen at all to what your defence may be, but you will then have a CCJ or county court judgment against you.
Yeah, it's quite disturbing. I don't know a lot about it myself, I must admit. But I mean, what's sort of worst, really, in general, is that denying people effective access to sort of redress or to set the record straight, and the centralising of things, the virtualisation of a lot of the systems we now rely on, makes it harder and harder for people to get sort of genuine kind of authoritative documents, put them in front of the right authority, and get the fair outcome.
Martin Summers, this place in Northampton doesn't seem like the ordinary county court, as you're saying there, some companies process tens of thousands of claims against people through this court, and the court just rubber stamps them without actually listening to their defence.
Well, I mean, if you think about Capita and organisations like that take over local authority functions supposedly to save money, and effectively what you're doing is you're privatising what are essentially public functions, mm-hmm. for commercial reasons, and then of course the people who have been dealing with it are dealing with people who are basically money making.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll put a link up to the Mail article and to the Moneybox programme, because they've got a couple of links where you can go and see if you've actually got one of these secret county court judgments against you by some company, and hopefully we can nip this in the bud, folks. How a single complaint about litter exposed failings in Bristol City Council's complaints procedure. This is Ian Onions, good old Ian Onions, political editor or correspondent, whatever he is, in the Bristol Post. Bristol businessman has exposed a culture of inaction when making a complaint to Bristol City Council. I can remember sending one of my complaints I made to Bristol City Council years ago. They didn't do anything about it at the Bristol Post, but anyway, this chap has obviously managed to get their ear. Mr. Jones, 38, runs a refuse and cleaning firm with 20 staff, went to the Post to reveal the council's inept complaints procedure that makes sure bureaucratic boxes are ticked, but there are rarely any tangible results. Now, his complaint was pretty simple, Martin Fodor. It's just about rubbish being left along his road week after week by people who are coming to collect the recycling. And, of course, he went through the whole procedure, proper procedure, apparently, with the City Council, but nothing at all was done.
Yes, it's very disappointing, frankly. You might not be surprised to hear that local councillors get a lot of complaints about things like litter, waste left behind after recycling, and so on.
So should he have gone to his local councillor, somebody like you? Would it have made any difference, do you think?
I'm always happy to help people. What I always say is make the official complaint first, because that will be logged and registered properly, and you'll then have a receipt that it was received, and you can track that. If it then goes wrong, I'm usually, or my equivalent elsewhere, I hope, are happy to then chase it and to try to get things looked into. But I'd like there to be an accurate log of how many people are making complaints and where and when. One of the problems with the sort of cost cutting and the tendering process that drives all these local authority services, as the other Martin just recently said, privatised services, services that are run arm's length from the council, is that if they cut costs, they're going to start dropping stuff, literally. dropping
litter.
Well,
you've also got the situation where it'll be a somebody working for the city council, although there's going to be 1,000 less of those soon, apparently.
There are.
Apparently. Will be trying to contact someone from the contractor, and if the contractor doesn't want to talk to them, well, yeah. What are they going to do?
I scrutinise these services, the waste recycling and sort of resource services, and we've always said very clearly, because of the change towards the Bristol-owned Bristol Waste Company, council-owned business, now delivering the service that after Keir parted company, let's say, with the council, is there still needs to be an effective client and contractor division. We still need to have the client who's keeping the eye on thing and the contractor that's delivering what they promised to deliver. And we need that because we have to scrutinise how well they deliver what they promised.
So is it going to happen?
We've actually put our foot down, on, so to speak, and said that there still needs to be someone in the council who's fielding all the council and its residents' complaints. Because we need that. We don't just want to say, we're telling the company, and yeah, sure, we'll sort it out with the company. You know, we want there to be a client function that's run by the elected council.
Martin Summers, it doesn't matter who you write to. There just seems to be a culture among staff of making sure nothing stays in their in tray and pinging it over to someone else. I can imagine the council gets hundreds of complaints. Some of these people at City Hall are trying their best, but nothing ever gets done. You're just fobbed off from one person to another. You end up going around in circles. Well, that's course, that's exactly what the council wants, because then it means it doesn't have to actually do anything.
Well, I mean, obviously there's going to be problems of bureaucracy and lack of responsiveness in any organisation, to be realistic. But I think the real problem is, as both of us have stressed, is once you create arm's length organisations which aren't directly run by the council. I mean, back in the bad old days, you know, Bristol City Council used to own the Bristol Bus Company, for example, which ran all the buses.
Well, this Bristol Waste Firm does seem a bit like this. So it might be that the situation has kind of superseded this complaint, because this apparently, at the end of the article, it's saying that this Bristol Waste Company actually is supposed to be dealing with complaints direct rather than through the council.
This is what we were quibbling. We don't mind them dealing with the complaints, but we also want the client to be monitoring how responsive and effective it is, because we, as councillors or residents or the local authority that's paying for this service, we have to know that the service is delivered. And if there are more litter complaints, more stuff gets dropped and, you know, not done properly, we need to keep an eye on that, and that's part of our scrutiny function. We get quarterly reports about this at the body called Neighbourhood Scrutiny that I sit on. And we need to know that they're delivering the recycling they're meant to deliver, they're picking up the litter, they're not causing a mess in, you know, in the side of actually carrying out these functions.
Well, there's no promises questions this week, that they're, because Theresa May has been over at the United Nations in New York, and various other things have been going on. Party conference season started. So let's have a listen now, and there's some issues that haven't gone away, to some one of the Prime Minister's questions from last week, which we didn't cover on this show last week, which is about the reduction in the number of members of Parliament. And this is actually looking as if it may be turning into a bit of gerrymandering by the Tory party.
David Winnick.
How can she try and justify reducing the House of Commons to 600 while the House of Lords now have 820 members, and certainly by 2020 even more? This is her idea of democracy in the 21st century.
I have to say to the Honourable Gentleman that, of course, the House of Commons voted for that reduction in the number of members of Parliament. I think people wanted to see that. But I would gently remind him, when he refers to the House of Lords and changes in the House of Lords, that it's actually this government that has introduced the retirement procedures for the House of Lords that has seen a reduction in the number of members of the House of Lords.
Well, I mean, the real problem here is that we are basically going to redraw the electoral boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers as before Brexit. So 2 million people registered to vote in the referendum, but they're not going to be included in the boundary changes. And we know, I know from political campaigning in this inner city area where we're currently located, that there are many people who are not on the electoral register, particularly in inner city areas. And the boundary, you could argue that if you're going to have equal constituencies, then they should be on the basis of the population, not on the basis of who's registered to vote, because MPs are supposed to represent everybody, even people who don't vote. But of course, what's really going on is our already unfair electoral system, which is, you know, designed to create a virtually permanent Tory government, is going to be made even more ridiculously unfair, not least because there's no proportional representation as we've got in Northern Ireland, etc. And I think we're going to reach a situation quite possibly where we could have a general election and a Corbyn-led Labour Party say we're not going to accept the results because the result's not fair.
Well, there are people saying that about the last general election, because we've got 20 constituencies where it's pretty clear the Conservative Party defrauded the public with its electoral spending returns, and where there apparently are police investigations, although I haven't seen any of those come to any kind of conclusion, over the whether or not those MPs on those elections are valid and may have to be rerun. Martin Fodor, what do you make of this? Because it's a little bit concerning. I mean, there was an article in The Guardian, I think it was tail end of last year, which I'll put a link up to on our show page, which was saying that the Tories are going to try and be in power for the rest of our lives. This is what they're saying, apparently. Yeah, the Guardian is saying, anyway.
Quite frightening. We've got a government elected with, 24% of the electorate, but a majority government. It is so disproportionate that we certainly need to change the voting system. And yes, everyone ought to. We don't have an obligation to vote in this country, of course. You don't have to vote. But I would like to see everyone registered who can be registered. It's become harder. We know that from knocking on doors. People who aren't registered, they've moved, they're in temporary accommodation, they lose their vote, and then you get boundaries set based on an out-of-date register for people who weren't even on it. So it's disproportionate in that sense. And then you get results that are first past the post that certainly locally we think denied us several seats if we had a proportion of the council that we have based on our proportion of our vote.
Martin Summers, it seems as if the more like a gypsy you are, the less chance you are of actually having any say in the way the country's run. And of course, there are a lot of students out there moving quite frequently, the younger generation being denied a voice.
Well, yes, and that would all be bad enough if they weren't trying to change the constituency boundaries on the basis of these corrupt registers. I repeat what I said earlier. If you want to have equal constituencies, you should be equal on the basis of population, the whole population, not the population registered to vote. And, of course, that used to be the case before the franchise was extended to all adults, is that the MP was supposed to virtually represent the poor who didn't have a vote because they didn't have own property, but they were virtually represented by their MP, and the constituency boundaries were drawn on the basis of population, not on the basis of electoral registers. And you know, the system in this country is just not fit for purpose.
Well, in this article I was referring to a great Tory power grab in The Guardian at the end of last year, the Tories have found themselves in government, probably to their surprise, and they've realised their hold on power is thin, says Norman Baker, former Lib Dem MP, coalition minister. They want to make sure they stay there. There's a window until the opposition reasserts itself. In August, Baker warned in The Independent, Britain was in danger of becoming a one-party state. He said, those interested in the continuation of a viable multi-party democracy need to wake up. Labour MP Chris Bryant, Shadow Leader of the Commons, is blunter. I think the Conservatives are rigging the system massively.
Well, they are. And of course, people will remember what they're proposing to do is to run the whole of Britain pretty much like Northern Ireland was run before 1969. And we all know that ended so well. The inner cities are being deliberately disenfranchised. And I think that the Tory shires and the people representing the Tory shires who pushed it through, I think they are playing with fire.
What do you think of the potential abuses in postal votes and proxy votes? Because that doesn't really seem to have been dealt with.
Well,
even though we know, certainly in London, this system's been massively abused, where you basically just pay somebody for their vote and then they give you their form and you send that in as if it's theirs.
I've heard of these allegations. I've also visited residential homes where there are a lot of people with dementia or certain, you know, memory issues and confusion, and you find they are all registered, they all have a vote there, and someone's helping them get their vote through postal votes or proxy votes. So, you know, the system is open to abuse at all ends of the scale, from the youngest who haven't got a vote or move too frequently to keep their vote wherever it was registered, to older people whose vote might be potentially misused. And, you know, this, we've just had a referendum on the slogan, you know, take back control, and then we find these sort of things going on. It's quite disturbing, really.
Okay, Bristol neighbours blockaded home this week to prevent a revenge eviction after mum complains about damp. Now, this is one of those things that almost, you know, kind of almost tear-jerking, really, when you see a whole line of people trying to stop somebody being evicted. None of the journalists who reported on this, it wasn't reported in the national press at all, a home in Easton, in York Road, she was being kicked out because she complained, Martin, about the damp conditions inside. And yet there was a whole load of people turned up to stop the eviction.
Well, I think it's full marks to the people who turned up to support the person.
This is Acorn. If people want to join, you know, it's obviously a good organisation.
Yeah, my colleague Councillor Clear Lake was on that blockade and took part in this, and we've done quite a bit of work with Acorn. We brought their motion, as our Green Party Golden Motion, one guaranteed a debate, to the council to get support for their ethical letting charter. And I have to say, I'm utterly impressed at the energy and the dedication they're putting into all of these campaigns over tenants' rights, deposits, landlords, managing agents, sort of behaviours, and the need to give people a decent home. And my colleague Carla Denyard said just the other day in a full council meeting, we don't just need an ethical letting charter, we need living rent, rents people can afford to pay, never mind the deposits that are ripping them off as well.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and Martin Fodor, the two Martins, thanks very much for joining us on this first hour. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. That was Martin Fodor's Green Councillor for Redland, you heard.
Thanks.
After the news, 100 years ago this week, the Battle of the Somme was raging. Why did Britain turn down the option for peace?
This is Bristol.